Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Beckett, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday, the 26th of July, these are our main stories. The UN's Chief of Human Rights says the international community is ignoring attacks on civilians carried out by the Syrian government. Pro-democracy protesters have been staging a sit-in at Hong Kong International Airport. And
people still have some wounds to heal. There are people who do not even still know where their beloved ones were thrown after being killed in the genocide against the Tutsi.
How one young man in Rwanda walked across his country to commemorate the massacres of 1994. Also in this podcast, Amazon shares are dropping in value. We find out what's going on. And
it's like winning the lottery. Like, what would you do if you won the lottery? Because so much money.
$30 million are up for grabs at the Fortnite World Cup in New York. So what's the appeal of this online game? The United Nations has criticised the international community for failing to condemn Syrian government airstrikes on civilians in the rebel-held area of Idlib. Our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher, told me more about what the UN has been saying.
Well, basically, it's talking about an offensive that's been going on in the northwest of Syria for the past 3 months. Syrian government, its allies have been pounding villages, towns, day in, day out, often hundreds of airstrikes and artillery strikes a day. And we've seen an upsurge just in this past week on Monday. It's believed about 59 people were killed. And there doesn't seem any end in sight. The strategy by the government is to try to open up key highways that rebels still have some control of and can disrupt. But it's been in a kind of stalemate, really. So we're seeing the level of civilian deaths and of the deaths of children as well rising in a way we haven't seen for some time. And that's what the UN is basically trying to remind the world of.
And is the UN justified in saying that the international community appears to have turned its back?
Well, the point that the UN is making, that Michelle Bachelet, the UN human rights chief, is making is that there's nothing new in this. This has gone on throughout the conflict, that the UN Security Council has been paralysed and that it's the fault of the Security Council, of the international community at large, that it hasn't done enough to stop what's going on. She says that this is a tragedy that we've essentially become inured to, that people don't even relate to it anymore. There's an indifference, a shrug of the shoulder. Now, occasionally that changes. As I was saying earlier this week, the casualties rose again. And there was one picture some of the listeners may have seen of a little girl trying to hang on to a member of her family in the rubble of her home and her father above her looking down and screaming for her to protect herself. The later report suggests that that girl fell and she died. Now, that's the kind of picture that brings back into the public a sense of the real human cost of what's happening. But we've seen this again and again. It's had no real impact on the political machinations over this. And essentially, from the international community's perspective, at the moment, there isn't enough at stake or enough happening to actually do anything.
Sebastian Usher, our Arab Affairs editor. Now to Hong Kong, where pro-democracy protests have taken an unusual turn. As we record this podcast, demonstrators are holding a rally at Hong Kong's international airport, and some airport and airline staff are taking part in an effort to attract global attention to their concerns.
Hong Kong, yeah!
In the midst of it all is our correspondent, Stephen McDonnell.
Well, the crowd has been building and building as the afternoon's gone on. It started off as a sit-in organised by airline staff, especially those from the unions here, from industry unions like the Cathay Pacific Flight Attendants Union and the baggage handlers. But then other people have come and joined in to support them. Now, it is a peaceful sit-in in support of the pro-democracy movement here and is especially targeting the triad attacks from last weekend. So a lot of people are holding up signs here, criticising the underworld gangs who were there to attack activists on their way home using homemade weapons. Now, they're also, though, criticising the police for not being there when those triads attacked. And so there are many signs and banners here calling for an inquiry into that, wanting to know why it is, and some are even accusing at least certain number of officers of colluding with the triads to have them come out by force, break the spirit of the pro-democracy movement. But, you know, you can imagine you're arriving at Hong Kong International Airport today, you've got your trolley, your bags, you come through, you clear customs, and then they're passed through a tunnel of people chanting, "Free Hong Kong, free Hong Kong." And then you enter into the main body of the arrival hall, and there are thousands of people sitting on the floor in black protesting about this. So anybody arriving in Hong Kong today, there's no getting away from this. You would become immediately aware of the political crisis going on here and the concerns of those who've had this sit-in.
Stephen, this started as protests over a proposed extradition bill. Is the fact that these protests are now taking place in the airport a sign that the protest movement is gathering momentum?
Yes, well, I think it's gone well beyond calling for the end of that extradition bill now, because they've been bolstered by the effective defeat of that bill. Those mass marches we saw with many hundreds of thousands of people have led people to believe that they can have democracy, but I don't see how this crisis is going to end, though, because Beijing's not going to give them democracy, and yet this ever-growing movement is not going to give up unless they get something approaching that.
Stephen McDonald speaking to me from Hong Kong's International Airport. Now to the story of a young man called Ippolit Antigurirwa. Like many Rwandans who survived the genocide of 1994, Ippolit suffered enormously. At the age of 7, he saw his father being killed. It's now 25 years since those terrible events in which between 500,000 and 1,000,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus were slaughtered. And to mark this, Ippolit has just completed a walk across Rwanda that's taken him 100 days, one for each of the days when the massacres took place. Shama Khalil asked him how this idea came about.
I said, why not doing something that reminds me of what happened, just something to remind the world that it happened and it's there. These days where we have people who actively deny the genocide. And now I said, I would do it to remember and to also invite people to seek peace.
When you invited people to join you, what sort of stories did they tell you?
They were telling me the stories of their survival, the stories of how they have forgiven the people who actually killed their relatives. I was joined by some people who also took part in the genocide against the Tutsi and who were telling the stories of what they did and how they did it. And
so they were sharing their own stories of their side of the genocide.
Yeah, definitely.
How did you feel about that, though, hearing those stories?
I mean, I felt that at least there are traces and history. This is the history, and it's a big contribution to the world to say, you know, where did it come from and how they learned to be a killers of their neighbors. And that's important for me, because it's sharing the story and leaving the story alive, and it's there, and all the facts are there. So I think it's important, but also in the same story, that people who have said, I mean, I met a guy whose both parents and 6 siblings were killed in front of him in Gichumbi district, and he has written a letter to the killers and say, I have forgiven you, but I've forgiven you so that you take care of the world, so that you teach the world to be peaceful. And those are the stories I was looking for. But not only those, like, all the roads, all the rivers, all the things here have the stories they have witnessed.
Yeah, it's a story of a people and a place, of course. Has it also helped you to move on, to heal from what you've experienced?
Oh, yes. In the same walk, I've been writing letters to the people I remembered. I've been writing letters of peace, letters of remembrance. But also, you know, it's a time to say, I've walked all across the country. No one has said, are you a Tutsi, or are you a Hutu, or are you a Twa, or are you a survivor, or what? They saw me as a human being. They saw me as a person. They saw me as a Rwandan.
So from your walk, do you think your country has moved on now?
Yeah, a lot. Collectively, we have made a very big step, but I have to acknowledge that people are still, like individuals, individually people still have some wounds to heal, that people who do not even still know where their beloved ones were thrown after being killed in the genocide against the Tutsi. It's a journey.
Hippolyte Antigo-Riawa talking there to Shaima Khalil. This year, several schools in the city of Birmingham in central England became embroiled in a bitter row with Muslim parents after young children were taught about same-sex relationships. The government has been encouraging schools to bring LGBT rights and transgender issues into the classroom. But the chief executive of the trust, which runs schools in Birmingham, caught up in the row, has accused the government of making her suspend its equality programme. Our correspondent Seema Kotecha says the children learn about same-sex couples in books.
They are introduced to the idea of different relationships from around 5 years old through storybooks like Mama, Mummy and Me, which is about a child with two mummies. This is actually about pictures in storybooks. Actually, some parents do still find that very offensive. I've been covering this story for about 6 months now, and there are people of various faiths who say that even though they're just pictures of same-sex couples, they think it's still sending a message out there. And some people genuinely believe that that has the power to turn a child gay. So Hazel Pulley has said that she was pressurised into suspending her equality programme because there were protests going on outside her school for weeks. People were chanting things like, "Our children, our choice." They wanted the school to stop teaching children about different relationships. Now the government has denied that, saying that any suggestion the dispute should be kept out of the media was about bringing an end to the protests and ensuring tensions weren't further inflamed by what it calls sensationalist coverage.
Seema Kotecha. You're listening to Global News, the best stories, interviews and on-the-spot reporting from the BBC World Service. Every weekend you can hear a review of the week's main news stories and why they matter. That's in The World This Week, and Caroline Wyatt joins me now to tell me what's in the latest edition.
The man who said he had a better chance of being reincarnated as an olive than becoming Prime Minister became the British Prime Minister. Boris Johnson began by promising a new golden age of sunshine for the UK and Brexit by Halloween. Ukrainians voted overwhelmingly for the party supporting their president, a former comedian. Moscow and Beijing flaunted their military alliance in the skies, exploiting splits between South Korea and Japan. And we'll find out more about sailing in space, as a craft with sails thinner than a human hair orbits in the skies above us, powered entirely by sunshine.
Thanks, Caroline. And that's all in The World This Week, broadcast on Saturdays and Sundays and available to download from our website, www.bbc.co.uk/programmes. And still to come in this edition of our own podcast.
If I didn't know, I'd think that that was a triple shot of neat vodka.
Yeah.
And this is from the garden.
So what exactly is it? Keep listening and you'll find out. Its share of America's online retail market is bigger than Apple, eBay and Walmart combined. But Amazon has failed to deliver with its latest profits. Shares in the company dropped by over 2% after it revealed second quarter profits of $2.6 billion, well short of analysts' expectations. But revenues are still growing at Amazon and Google's parent, Alphabet. So what's going on here? A question for our business correspondent, Theo Leggett.
We shouldn't criticise them too much because a profit of $2.6 billion is still pretty high by most people's standards, and revenues increased by 20% to $63.5 billion. So, you know, this is still a huge company making a lot of money. It did fall a little bit short of analysts' expectations, but that's the problem that these tech giants now face. Expectations around them are so high that when they miss even by a little bit, their share price falls. And they're under a lot of pressure to keep the growth up, to keep the profits increasing, and so on. And in fact, Amazon did see its revenues grow quite substantially, but it's having to invest a lot of money as well. That's part of this. It's facing a lot of competition. It wants to retain its preeminent position in the online marketplace, so it's investing a lot of money at the moment in next day delivery. And basically subsidising next day delivery for its prime customers, which means that it's having to spend more in order to stay where it is, in order to keep the growth going. And that's hit its bottom line a little bit, but it's not doing badly. Meanwhile, Alphabet, Is doing extremely well. That had profits after tax for the quarter of $9.9 billion, a substantial increase on the year before, and revenues of $38.9 billion. So you have these two tech giants which are really showing their muscle. And that, I'm afraid, is what's attracting the attention of competition regulators.
Well, indeed. So the question now becomes, what is the future looking like?
Well, you would say that at the time when the American authorities are showing they have the tech industry on the radar, perhaps it's not great to be coming up with bumper profits, but then that's what their investors depend on. Clearly, these companies are going to come under a lot of scrutiny. They will be arguing very hard that they're acting fairly, that they're in a fair marketplace, and that they're simply doing what they do very well. But don't forget as well, these are two highly diversified companies. You just look at what Alphabet's been doing with its investment in Waymo, self-driving vehicles, all that sort of thing. They have to be a bit careful about how far they diversify and how much control they retain over those diversified activities, because otherwise regulators' attention will be drawn to them more and more and more. And we've already seen in Europe what can happen when regulators don't like what you're doing, because the tech industry, certainly in Europe, has been under the microscope already and some pretty big fines have been levied.
Theo Leggett, our business correspondent. Now, how do you make tap water exciting? How about branding it as an upscale drink with a slick marketing campaign and a trendy pop-up bar? That is exactly what the Icelandic government is doing. And Elizabeth Hodson's been finding out why.
I'm at the Blue Lagoon in southwest Iceland. It's a one-of-a-kind spa complex made of naturally milky silica pools. They're heated by hot springs hundreds of metres below the Earth's surface. And in common with waterfalls and glaciers, the Blue Lagoon makes a feature of one of Iceland's most precious natural resources, water. Its location, only 30 minutes away from Keflavik International Airport, also makes it one of the major stops on the tourist trail. And tourism is a rapidly growing industry, with numbers increasing from the hundreds of thousands around 10 years ago to a current figure of 2.3 million. And whilst tourism is vital to the economy, it also creates problems for the environment. And one of these is plastic bottles. I've moved 200 kilometres down the coast to Skógafoss waterfall. It's one of the biggest in the country and millions of litres of water gush down every hour. Some of it will find its way into Icelandic homes and businesses. And the Icelandic government is encouraging tourists to drink more of it too, which is why they're marketing it as an upscale consumer brand, Kranavan. Back at the airport, I met local bar owner George Late, the face of the campaign.
The unique ingredients used to make Kranava are the same that formed this glacier thousands of years ago, only after being naturally filtered through layers of lava over the centuries, are they pure enough to meet the high standards that make Kranava the greatest drink in the world.
I'm here, the bartending for the Kranava bar, and we are doing some mixology and tasting of Kranava.
You've got four taps on, and it looks like it's some kind of maybe trendy craft beer, but it's actually something completely different.
Yeah, actually is tap water. So I have four types. So Þvottahús Kranavatn is my laundry. Gæslungur Kranavatn is from my garden. The Bílskúr one is from my garage, and the Bavask is from my toilet.
It's such a lovely day outside. I think I'll try the garden water, please.
The garden one? Yes. Do you want a shake or stir?
Let's have it shaken.
Okay, nice.
If I didn't know, I think that was a triple shot of neat vodka.
Yeah. This looks like a neat vodka, but it's pure water.
And this is from the garden?
That's from my garden, yeah. Exactly.
In reality, it's all the same, and this is all part of the marketing campaign.
Yeah, the campaign is don't waste your time and money on plastic bottles.
Domestic consumers already drink tap water. They don't really consume bottled water. This is for tourists from abroad, basically.
Mm. Yeah, I think like more than 80% of people that are drinking bottled water in Iceland is just a tourist. When you walk around and you see bottles everywhere, and you're just like, why people are buying water? For us Icelandic, it's unbelievable seeing people just go to the supermarket and buy water, because we can just drink everywhere for free.
What do you think supermarkets think of this? Because if they aren't going to be selling any more bottled water, surely that's going to hit their profits.
Yeah, I hope they hate us. And I think also they're going to, in the end of the day, they're going to just realise that we are just thinking about the environment and that it's good for everyone.
George Late, a bar owner from Iceland, ending that report by Elizabeth Hodson. Now, tens of thousands of fans have descended on the Arthur Ashe Stadium in New York for the eSport finals of the Fortnite World Cup.
Who is the other player in the play? Oh! Here it is! He's going for the big X! Oh! That is why he's a World Cup qualifier!
After months of shooting each other online, players who've reached the final will meet in real life to play this hugely popular game for a chance of winning huge sums of money. The game has 250 million regular players, and the event is likely to be watched by millions online. The contenders are playing for the largest prize pool in the history of esports, with $30 million to be shared amongst the finalists. Those taking part have been preparing very hard, sometimes playing for at least 8 to 10 hours a day, in preparation for this weekend.
It's a lot more serious than people think. It took a lot of work to qualify. So it's not just playing the game for fun or whatever. You have to play like consecutive months, a lot, every day.
I mean, I think the prize pool, I'd probably just save most of the money. I know what Benji would do, though, if you want to tell.
Buy a house.
It's like winning the lottery. Like, what would you do if you won the lottery? Because so much money.
Victory Royale!
I mean, I think it'll be a bit different when I'm on the stage because I've never been on a huge stage like that before. I've only ever played in my bedroom.
So what is the appeal of the game? Dan Damon put that question to Keza McDonald, the video games editor for The Guardian newspaper in London.
Fortnite is a battle royale game. What that means is that 100 players start out on a big island, and by the end, only one remains. So it's a very popular competitive game played mostly by people under 18. One of the reasons that Fortnite's become so popular is because it's got a kind of cartoonish, accessible art style. It's not grim and realistic. It's not a military shooter. It's a really fun game, and it's got lots of silly weapons, and it's a place that kids feel more welcome than they would in the more serious games that tend to dominate these big esports tournaments. So that's actually part of the key to its appeal, is it's quite approachable.
You said kids. I'll use the more official phrase, under 16s. And most of those, or a lot of those, who are taking part in this competition, this Fortnite World Cup, they are under 16, aren't they?
Yeah, the majority of the 100 finalists, of the 40 million people who attempted to qualify for the World Cup, the majority of the finalists are 12 to 16-year-old boys. And that's basically Fortnite's core audience. It's mostly teenagers.
Most of them are male as well. Why don't girls like this?
Lots of girls play Fortnite. I think that it's one of those things about video games that's been the case since the 90s, especially in teenagers. It is kind of still a male-dominated pastime in genres like this. When it comes to competitive games, shooter games, sports games, anything like that, fighting games, it does tend to be pretty male-dominated. I think there are lots of cultural reasons for that.
Is it horribly misogynistic like some of the other games?
Fortnite's definitely not got that particular problem. It's definitely not misogynistic.
So I'm trying hard not to sound like a grumpy old man here, but I suppose the thing which worries me about it is that there's a lot of money in this. These are young people who are potentially going to have their lives changed by earning a lot of money, by doing it in this kind of online, unreal way. They're in this fantasy world. Is that good for them?
I think that being a professional video game player has become like being a professional footballer. Every kid in the world wants to be a professional game player, but very, very few will be able to make it. And I think the odds of making even a living out of playing games professionally are very, very small. But that doesn't mean that millions of kids aren't trying. One thing to understand about Fortnite is, you know, it might look from the outside like a fantasy world. It's basically a place that kids go to hang out with their friends. It's a place they go to play together. It's like a real hangout spot, just online. And this is something that's difficult to conceptualize for those of us that didn't grow up with the internet. But it's not a fantasy world of their own construction. It's very much people competing in a sport, just in the place is online as opposed to the concept, if that makes sense.
Keza McDonald, video games editor for The Guardian newspaper, speaking to Dan Damon. And now we come to the final part of our podcast, when we tell you about a few less reported stories of the week from around the world. With me in the studio is Yin Lee from the BBC monitoring team, which follows local news in many languages. Yin, I understand there's a bit of a transport theme to the stories this week.
Yes, there are taxis, planes and street art in my stories this week. The first one comes from Singapore, where drivers for popular ride-hailing apps have been found to have hacked or modified the apps they've been using to boost their earnings. Do you know how these work?
Do explain.
When you use these apps to request a driver, the fare that you're charged is based on demand. So when there are more passengers wanting a driver than there are drivers, the fares go up. David Sun, the journalist investigating the story, said he believes that drivers in certain areas are colluding in not accepting rides from passengers or cancelling them. Now, normally they'd be penalised for doing this, but the modified apps enable them to sidestep that.
So with fewer drivers available, the prices go up?
Yes, and then the drivers accept passenger rides at higher fares. Now, Grab and Gojek are two of just many ride-hailing companies that work in Singapore, and they say they're aware of the practice, but they wouldn't say how many drivers have been caught using such apps. They did say, though, that they wouldn't hesitate to penalise any driver doing so.
Right. Is there apparently more taxiing in the next story?
There is. So one enterprising 13-year-old boy in Huzhou City in China has been offered a rare chance to learn to fly, despite getting into quite a bit of trouble over airplanes. Now, he broke into the local airport early one morning and took two amphibious planes for a joyride. Surveillance cameras caught him crashing one plane and then taxiing another in circles before leaving the airfield.
Was he hurt?
He wasn't hurt, but he did cause damages of over $1,000. Police gave him a strict warning and his family have agreed to pay a fine. But the lucky boy has also had an offer from the airport's director to train as a pilot, because apparently the director was so impressed with his ability to control the plane despite having no experience of flying.
So lucky 13 indeed, I guess. And so from the runway to street art, tell us about that.
Well, Russia's industrial city, Yekaterinburg, was lucky enough recently to have a very striking piece of art painted on one of its streets. Imagine a blood-red stained glass window, the size of a couple of football fields, with a black cross in the middle covered in white calligraphy. This was the work of the street artist Pokras Lampas, and it was commissioned as part of a local festival. So the last thing residents expected a few days after it was finished was for a roadworks team to turn up and to begin covering it in tarmac, because apparently they were repairing a pedestrian crossing nearby.
Oh no, was it ruined?
Well, fortunately they stopped after local authorities were alerted and only 10 to 15 metres of the artwork were covered. But many people, including the region's governor, were outraged. Yekaterinburg's mayor said the incident was due to carelessness and he's vowed to restore the artwork. Have we got time for one more story?
Yeah, go on.
We wouldn't be BBC Monitoring without a language story. And this week's comes from Peru, where a magistrate's court has been praised for issuing a ruling written entirely in Quechua, the language of the Inca Empire, from hundreds of years ago. So Quechua is still spoken in the Andes mountain regions in Peru, Ecuador and Argentina. And this week, a magistrate ruling in a dispute between two native speakers had the court proceedings as well as the ruling translated by specialists to increase inclusion and access to justice for more Peruvians, the country's news agency said. Quechua has had official status in Peru since 1975, but it's still largely spoken rather than written down, and you tend to hear it far more in rural areas than in the media or courts of law normally.
Interesting. Thank you very much, Yin Lee, from our monitoring team, with that selection of stories from across the globe. And that's all from us now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Tanya Beckett, and until next time, goodbye.
Hello, I'm Marnie Chesterton, and I present the Crowd Science podcast from the BBC World Service. Crowd Science is a podcast that has the sweet remit of taking our listeners' questions about anything scientific and trying to answer them with the help of scientists from around the world. We get everything from, is there life after death, and what's beyond the limits of the universe, to what's inside the dust in my vacuum cleaner. Crowd Science goes to wherever the cutting-edge research is taking place. I've been put on a starvation diet, I've gargled with millions of viruses, I've had to run alongside marathon runners in the dark in almost horizontal rain during a hurricane in Greece. But that's part of the show. We try and get to where people are doing things, where people are trialing things, and you see the science taking place before your eyes. That's Crowd Science from the BBC World Service. Just search for Crowd Science wherever you get your podcasts.